Oh, thank you so much. Whew. I'll see if I have any energy left here. Just listening to that was really uplifting. Thank you. I'm going to read a few lines from Meditation by the Reverend Greta Crosby to preface what I'll be sharing with you. Sometimes when the bottom falls out of our life, we are set free. We attain enlightenment, or an enlightenment of sorts, some perspective, some clarity, some sense of reality, some sense of dealing with things as they are. Whenever that profound thing happens, we can expect to go through a process, sometimes a long process, a painful or at least uncomfortable process, in which we let go of something and slowly learn how to live again. This is true no matter what we lose. A loved one, a work, a hope, a vision, an image of ourselves, a part of ourselves. Loss makes artists of us all as we weave new patterns into the fabric of our lives. A little over 30 years have gone by now since I lost my father. And since his death took place around this time of year, about a month or so earlier than we are now, I find myself thinking about it, thinking back to it, as this time of year comes around. My father's story, I've shared parts of it with you before, is largely about his struggling to make something of himself and raise his family as he came out of the backcountry of West Virginia in the years before and during the Great Depression, and then after his service in the Second World War. Even as a youngster growing up in the Charleston, West Virginia area, I was aware of how hard he worked as a self-employed house painter with an eighth grade education, and of how tight things got in our family when jobs would become scarce. He was a very quiet and undemonstrative man, while still feeling the weight of his family responsibilities on him, as he and my mother seemed like they were always trying to make ends meet. So when my father died, and he was only at the age of 69, I experienced more than the feelings of loss one would expect to feel at the death of a loving and caring parent. I felt that, to be sure. But I also felt, some vaguely undefined way, that some kind of a cosmic injustice had been done. As the year 1979 came around, my parents had finally reached some measure of financial stability in their lives. My sisters and I were all married, on with our lives. We were out of the house. It was time for Mom and Dad to get back a little for all they had given, all they had sacrificed on our behalf. But it didn't quite work out that way. My father, as just noted, died at the age of 69. It was due to a rare kind of brain tumor that took his life only a few months after it was discovered. And the most likely cause of it, it was never completely substantiated, but the most likely cause was from his many years of inhaling the fumes of the oil-based paint that he used in his work before water-based latex paint came into widespread use. In a way analogous to black lung disease, my dad's work most likely killed him. Took away what could have been a much more relaxed time in his life. My Eddington grandfather, my father's father, on the other hand, lived to the age of 90, did gardening on his small farm. He got to see his grandchildren grow to adulthood. And I remember wondering why my father didn't get the years that his father did. Why didn't he get to tend his gardens? See his grandchildren grow up. And as I still recall, as I said, the more I thought these thoughts, the more unfair everything seemed. What happened to my dad just wasn't fair. Well, this all took place right about the time when I was coming into the Unitarian Universalist ministry. I was still kind of trying out my humanist clothing there, as it were. And rationally, I knew there was no one to blame. for my father's passing in the way that had occurred. I knew it was pointless to shake my fists at the heavens the way Tevye does from time to time in the play Fiddler on the Roof when he gets frustrated at God for one reason or another. I couldn't do that. I figured nobody up there listening, nobody cares. Why shake my fist? But then, as just noted, that still didn't stop me from asking on some visceral level that went somewhere beyond the rational why this had to be. Well, of course, it was questions asked out of grief and anger. And even I didn't have a particular place or a particular person to direct such questions to, the feelings behind them. Feelings behind them were very real nonetheless. Well, questions that are asked out of grief and anger are just that, expressions of grief and anger. On that level, they are certainly legitimate as such. They are not questions for which there is a rational answer. We all know that. Most of us do, I think. And as I got some reflective distance on my father's death, I was then able to turn the questions around. It took a while to get there, but I was able to turn the questions around and ask more pointed questions of myself. Why am I demanding that life always be fair and just and always work out right? Why do I demand justice in such a situation? And when I get into this mode of thought, I often wind up, of all places, at the book of Job. So let's go there for a few moments, and I'll loop back in and pick up some of what I read from Greta Crosby here. The Job story in the Hebraic/Christian scriptures is really one version of a very ancient folk tale that's probably been around in one form or another ever since human beings could think and tell stories. It deals with the universal question of why good people suffer. Other versions are found in some of the other religions of the ancient Near East. In much more recent times, the playwright Archibald MacLeish even got a Broadway play out of the whole thing titled J.B. You probably know the biblical version. Job and Satan make a wager as to whether a good, righteous, and prosperous man like Job, God and Satan make a wager as to whether a good, righteous, and prosperous man like Job can be pushed to the point where he'll turn on God. So Job, inexplicably, since he's unaware that he's a part of a cosmic bet, loses everything he has, including his children, and then he gets these horrible boils all over his body. He's kind of sitting there completely at the bottom of his life. And then he has these three friends who come to visit him, and each one of them gives this big, long discourse as to why Job is having to endure everything he's enduring. They're not a whole lot of help. There's an object lesson just in this part of the story alone, which is when a friend of yours is having a hard time, the last thing they need from their friends are attempted explanations as to why it's all happening. All they really need is your loving and your caring presence. Job's friends, unfortunately, did not get that memo, and they didn't have Paul Simon or our choir around to sing Bridge Over Troubled Water to them, which is what the attitude should have been when they went to see Job. Instead, they sit, and if you read the thing, it just goes on for chapter after chapter about why all this stuff is happening. There's poor Job sitting there destitute of his boils, having listened to all this. And Job finally does crack. He flat out loses it. Like Peter Finch's character in the movie Network, he gets mad as hell and can't take it anymore. He lets loose. He rails at God at the unfairness and the injustice of everything that has befallen him. And God answers Job through a whirlwind. Whirlwinds seem to have been the main mode of communication that the Almighty used in those days. Everywhere in the Old Testament, God's going around speaking through whirlwinds. And this is what he said through the whirlwind to Job. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe? Well, as my worldview became less theistic and more humanistic, and as I took an increasingly critical view of the Bible that had been central to my religious upbringing, I pretty much tossed that passage aside. I decided it was a cruel, heartless, foolish, to say nothing of manipulative God being portrayed in this story and legend. I mean, Here is poor Job crying out in this terribly undeserved plight. And all he gets from God, in effect, is, look, I'm in charge here, so shut up and deal with it. God is not feeling Job's pain in this story. I decided this was a God I was not much interested in, much less able to believe in. But something kept pulling me back to that line. Even though I rejected the whole theological premise of the story, which has God and Satan playing out a cruel bet on some unsuspecting mortal, I had to ask myself, is there something I'm missing in this where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe question? Any kind of a coherent message here, even if I back out the whole God and Satan business? And I mulled that over for a while, and I eventually got a rephrased message. It went something like this. Who are you, Steve, to be demanding or even expecting life to always be fair and just? Where were you when the foundations of life and the workings of the universe were put in place? Well, nowhere to be exact, and that's the point. Life can come to us in beauty and in fullness, like the fullness of your grandfather's 90 years. And it can just as easily bring its cruelties and its unexplained losses as it did with your father. Furthermore, you can choose and shape your destiny to an extent. You can shape your life to an extent. And you should celebrate the choices and the opportunities that you have, but in the end, you don't control life. It gives and it takes away. And the real challenge of living, for as long as you're given to live, lies in being able to creatively respond to what is given, as well as to what is taken. It's like Joni Mitchell said, something's lost, something's gained in living every day. Man, that's a lot to pull out of one little verse. But somehow I did all that. As you can see, when I read the Bible, I have to give myself a pretty free rein on how I interpret what I read, which is the only way I can read it now, as a matter of fact. But that was the message that I finally got behind this whole where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe business. On that note then, I'll turn to that little meditation I offered by Reverend Greta Crosby. It is yet another of my pieces of personal scripture. In just a few short sentences, she writes in a positive and life-affirming way about living with loss, about when you're having to look at life from the bottom up. And on the first reading, however, I can imagine someone saying, wait a minute here, hold on, Greta. When the bottom falls out of my life, I feel confusion and fear and grief, and a loss of direction. What is this enlightenment and clarity and perspective you're talking about? You sure your name's not Pollyanna? Well, I don't know how Reverend Crosby would respond to such questions, but if I can back up a bit from her words, and then I'll come at them in a similar way I did with that passage from Job. Let's try this take on it. If I were to ask most of you what it means to have a positive, forward-looking, successful stance towards life, I imagine the answer would be along the lines of being able to see possibilities for oneself and acting on them. It would mean trusting and believing in your ability to take care of your most basic needs and fulfill at least some of your desires. Whether we like to admit it or not, we measure, in large part, what we call success and even our sense of self-worth by what it is we gain, both through our own efforts and through our occasional good fortune. And I'm not just talking about material gain here either. There are the more human and intangible gains we look for and we want to acquire, like a good family life, a good circle of friends, the respect of your peers, some inner peace, and a connection, however you may make it and name it, to some larger meaning or purpose to your life. These kinds of gains are necessary, I feel, for any kind of full and meaningful living. But now, alongside all this life as a good gains business, let me introduce a counterpoint. I think there's also a healthy and even, I think it is also healthy and even necessary to be able to recognize life as a series of losses. Some of those losses can be fairly well accepted. Others will come as cruel or tragic or unfair. Another of my personal scriptural texts to which I referred from time to time from this pulpit is a book now long out, it's still out there, by Judith Yorst called Necessary Losses. I'm not going to get into it here, except to say that in very broad terms, Ms. Yorst is writing about the things one needs to let go of and be willing to lose in the course of the life cycle in order for one's life to be reasonably whole. Being able to let go and accept loss is as valuable for our ongoing well-being as is our capacity and our need for gains. In terms of the personal examples I've been using this morning, I never felt the need to let go of the basic idea that my father's death was very unfair, given the overall context of his life. What I eventually did have to lose, however, was my need for everything to be fair and just when it came to how my father lived and died. That was my necessary loss. Moving quickly on, I know it's just plain scary to look at life from the bottom up. I think that's just why a certain discomfort that's often experienced in being around people who have taken some hard hits. I've had more than one person tell me how losing a job and being unemployed for a stretch was not only tough enough to deal with in and of itself, but they also had to deal with how some of their friends would be acting somewhat differently around them. There was a certain kind of uneasiness about them. And it wasn't, people would say this, and they would go on to point out very quickly, it wasn't that their friends were being fair-weather companions or turning on them or anything like that. That wasn't it. There was something else going on. It was the prospect of loss was personally unsettling to them, as if this could also happen to me as well. On a weightier level, I recall reading a line from a journal hit by a person whose life was nearing an end due to terminal cancer. He wrote in his journal, "I never knew what fear was until I looked into the eyes of the people who were looking at me." Maybe that was what was going on with Job's friends. Perhaps it was too frightening for them to just be with Job in the midst of all he was experiencing. So they had to take off on all these rationalizations about why it was happening instead. Well, to return to Reverend Crosby then, what she's trying to say with this little meditative piece is that to take what is fearful and unknown, and she says it can ultimately be life-enhancing. Not right away, to be sure. Recall, she also says, when that profound thing happens, we can expect to go through a process, sometimes a long process, a painful or at least uncomfortable process, in which we let go of something and slowly learn to live again. In those few words, she describes the life dynamic that runs alongside our gains and our accumulations. Letting go and learning to live again. In the case of a loved one, it does not mean that you will ever let go of the love and the affection or the appreciation you felt for that person. It means instead letting go over time of enough grief so that you can re-engage with life again. And as Greta Crosby goes on to say, this is true no matter what we lose. Not just talking about persons. A loved one, a hope, a vision, an image of ourselves. Of course, we have to have our dreams and our visions for ourselves. We need to be able to imagine lives we want and to which we aspire. To not do so would not be human. Another kind of loss is experienced in this respect, though, when the truth comes home that, well, certain things are just not going to happen when it comes to a vision or an aspiration we may have of ourselves. This doesn't mean there's something wrong with you, wrong with us. It only means you may need to let go of a particular lost hope or dream in order to live again with both a present and a future in what you can believe, in what you can still believe. This kind of letting go is far from easy, but it can also be a freeing experience. Free to be, as Ms. Crosby puts it in words I really love, artists, as we weave new patterns into the fabric of our lives. So I'll close with this. All of our gains, all of our losses, are, I believe, a part of a larger mystery of living, which we may not fully comprehend, but with which we fully keep faith. Oftentimes when I'm conducting a memorial service or a funeral service, I use a reading by the late now Unitarian Universalist minister, the Reverend Raymond Bond. He says, "We belong to the eternal here and now. We did not begin when we were born. Our origin goes back to the beginningless beginning of all things. Our story is the story of the earth, the sun, and humankind. Something eternal is revealed and contained in everything. Our bodies and mosaics are part of the same unknown that underlies the light, the star, and the sea. We do not fully know what it is, but we live it, and we call it life. We belong to the oneness from which we have emerged." What Ray Bond is telling us here is that our lives are part of some larger chain of being, part of a tree of life, to invoke a metaphor used earlier, whose complete meaning we may never fully grasp. As he puts it, we do not know what it is fully, but we live it, and we call it life. True indeed. And it's also true that we do get some occasional glimpses as to what it is as we live it. And some of the more revealing glimpses occur when we are able to return to life after feeling cut off from it. When we become the artists that loss calls us to be, weaving new patterns into the fabric of our lives. The joy is the discovery that life is still there for us when we are ready to return to it and become one with it again. Perhaps that is the enlightenment of what Greta Crosby speaks, that having lived the loss, we find the life is there to bless us and allow us to love it again. Let's sing together hymn number 348, "Guide My Feet."